Okay, so we should go ahead to page 3, which is a quick review of some representation theory. The root system of a Lie algebra is a way of describing its structure, independent of the choice of generators. We can start with whatever representation we want and pick R generators that mutually commute. The R-dimensional space, built using these generators, is called a Cartan subalgebra. We get a linear operator on the rest of the Lie algebra by putting the Cartan subalgebra elements in one side of the Lie bracket. This gives a set of eigenvectors, called root vectors, spanning the Lie algebra, each with a unique eigenvalue called a root. The root coordinates determine points of the root system in R-dimensional space. Now, the cool thing that happens here is the Lie bracket between two root vectors gives a third, only if their corresponding roots add to give the third. In this way, the pattern of the root system in R-dimensions, which can be quite pretty, corresponds to the structure of the Lie algebra, and it's independent of our choice of generators, which just correspond to a rotation of the root system. So we can also use our Cartan subalgebra to calculate eigenvectors and eigenvalues, called weight vectors and weights, corresponding to the Lie algebra action on any representation space. The pattern of weights describes the representation. For example, the roots are just the weights in the adjoint representation. Now, all of this connects to physics because these weight vectors, algebraically, are the particles, and the weights are the quantum numbers. And this gets a lot clearer with an example. So go ahead into the next page, please, page 4. The gluons live in SU3, shown here with the 8 Gell-Mann matrices as generators. The Cartan subalgebra on the diagonal of the matrix is two-dimensional, producing a root space with coordinates along U3 and G8 axes. Here's a typical root vector, the green anti-blue gluon, and the eigenequation gives its root coordinates, -1/2 and square root of 3 over 2. These gluons act on the quarks in the fundamental 3 representation space, with the red quark represented by this canonical unit vector, with weight coordinates of 1/2 and 1 over 2 root 3. The anti-quarks are in the dual representation with the opposite weights. So plotting these weights for the gluons and quarks makes a nice pattern, which we can see on page 5. The next page, please. These are the 6 gluon root vectors and roots of SU3, which are plotted as blue circles, and the 3 quark and 3 anti-quark weights of 3 colors, which are plotted as triangles and inverted triangles. The interactions correspond to Lie brackets, which correspond to vector addition of the weights in this pattern. So if we take the red anti-green gluon there on the far right by the G3 axis label, and add it as a vector to the green quark, that takes us to the red quark, which is the result of this interaction. Now, this is all standard representation theory, but there's something unusual here. This weight system is not just a weight system of gluons acting on quarks. It's also a root system. This is the root system for the smallest simple exceptional Lie group, G2. We can take the green quark and the red anti-green gluon to be the simple roots of this root system, and build this Dynkin diagram for this system, and this corresponds to G2, the smallest simple exceptional Lie group. So this diagram shows that we don't have to think of quarks as being in the fundamental 3 representation space. We can, in fact, treat them as Lie algebra elements of G2. Next page, please, page 6. The G2 Lie algebra breaks up into a SU3 subalgebra, which are the gluons, and the 3 and dual 3 identified as quarks and anti-quarks. The Lie bracket between gluons and quarks as root vectors of G2 gives all the interactions. The Feynman vertices for these particles. Now, this is a remarkable development. It implies that use of a particular representation for these elementary particles is not prescribed by nature, as we previously thought. Instead, the quarks and gluons live in the G2 Lie group, a nice symmetric manifold with the geometry described by the relations between its diffeomorphisms. And this doesn't only work for the quarks and gluons in G2. It's going to turn out to work like this for all other particles in the standard model, which may be identified as Lie algebra elements of the other exceptional Lie groups. First, I want to show you how we can describe Lie algebra root systems as projections of larger root systems so we can spot the subalgebras. The next page, page 7. So we're going to have here the root system SO7, which can be described as all edge and face midpoints of a cube in 3 dimensions, here in coordinates x, y, and z. The 8 weights of an SO7 spinner are at the vertices of a cube half this size. By rotating to new coordinates, d3, g8, and b2, and projecting along the b2 axis, all of these weights project down to the roots of g2, a subalgebra of SO7, and 2 project to the origin. This is a graphical representation of the well-known embedding of SUN in SO2N, and is a typical example of how to see a group as a subgroup of a larger one. These overlapping G2 roots exist at different levels of B2, which we can see by spinning the cube I just described. Now please page forward 4 pages. After rotating this cube, we can see there is a grading of this root system along the B2 direction. The B2 coordinate for these weights is related to the weak hypercharge for quarks and leptons. Next page, please. It should be page 12. It says the Tati-Salam model plus gravity. If we go back to our periodic table, we can see the B2 coordinates are the weak hypercharges for the left chiral leptons and quarks along the top two rows of this table. In order to get the correct hypercharges for all the fermions, we need another U1 field, part of B1, that acts to add and subtract 1 to the weak hypercharges of right chiral fermions along the bottom two rows of this table. By adding these two Bs to get our electroweak U1 field, we get the correct hypercharges for all the particles. This is actually an old idea. It's part of the Petit-Salam grand unified theory. The Petit-Salam model is a left-right symmetric theory. It adds a right SU2 partner, B1, to the left SU2 electroweak W. The third Pauli matrix in this SU2R is the B1-3 field that combines with B2. The other two fields in B1 must get large masses somehow, breaking this left-right symmetry, because we haven't seen them. So the Petit-Salam model implies the hypercharge comes from two independent sets of quantum numbers, B1-3 and B2. Once we've made this split, we can see from this pattern of interactions that the electroweak, Higgs, and gravitational field on the left-hand side of this diagram are all parts of some larger algebra. The biggest clue is that if the Higgs is going to give Dirac masses to the fermion, it's going to need to interact with their left and right chiral parts. Combining the Higgs with the gravitational frame will do this for us. Let me talk about gravity a bit so we can see how this works. Next page. The SO31 valued spin connection, with generators written here as Clifford algebra pi vectors, that was the CL231, can be broken up into left and right chiral parts built with Pauli matrices. More familiar is the self-dual and anti-self-dual parts of the connection. The Cartan subalgebra is the diagonal of this 4x4 matrix, and it gives up and down root vectors for the left and right chiral spin connection field, with corresponding root coordinates as shown in the table. The gravitational frame is a Clifford algebra vector, and breaks up into these weight vectors with the weights shown in the table. So the frame is that CL131 valued one form. Here I've gotten rid of the one form part, so you can see how it works algebraically. Now, when we write out the Dirac operator in curved spacetime, the spin connection acts on the fermions in the fundamental four representation space. So they're Dirac spinners, built from stacking two Weyl spinners with spin up and spin down parts as the weight vectors, and the spin quantum numbers shown in the table. When the frame interacts with the fermions, it mixes the left and right chiral parts, which we can see by multiplying the frame matrix, that's the E there, times the Dirac spinner, or by adding their weights in the table. For example, we could add the weights of the spatial up frame field, that's the one with the upwards caret above it, so we add those to a left chiral down fermion, and that gives us a right chiral up fermion as the allowed result of this interaction. And the structure of the electroweak interactions is very similar. And so we can see that on the next page. So please turn to the next page, page 14. We can identify the left chiral acting SU2, the W, and right chiral acting SU2, the B1, of the Petit-Salam model as parts of an SO4 electroweak connection. If we put the four Higgs fields in the vector of this SO4, we get the correct weights for the standard model Higgs, and the Petit-Salam model gives us the correct weights for the fermions. When we rotate the B2 coordinates for the fermions in with the B1-3 coordinate, that's the equation there at the bottom, we get the correct standard model hypercharges with the electroweak U1 coupling constant equal to the square root of 3/5. This gives the same prediction for the Weinberg angle as almost all grand unified theories, including SU5, SO10, and most others. This has to do with that rotation I showed you of the cube first, which gave the B2 charge. The electric charge quantum numbers come from adding W3 with half Y and are shown in the right-hand side of the table. Since we have gravity described by the SO31 spin connection, acting on the frame as a vector, And we have the electric weak connection as an SO4 acting on the 4 Higgs in the vector. It's very natural to combine all these as parts of a unified SO7-1 gravel weak connection. The next page, please, page 15. This is the combined SO7-1 gravel weak connection, with the frame and Higgs combined as a simple bivector. This is a very unusual feature. The frame and Higgs are parts of one composite field in this theory, with this frame Higgs field occupying 16 Lie algebra elements. We can take a chiral Clifford matrix representation for CL71 and use that, there on the bottom, to calculate the roots for the SO71 fields and the weights for the fermions, here as elements of the positive chiral eight-dimensional spinner. But that's the hard way to do it. The easy way is to just combine the two pairs of coordinates we already found to get the roots in four dimensions as shown in this table. Now, these 24 roots of the D4 root system that we end up with have a nice set of symmetries called triality. There are many planes through this root system such that if we rotate in one of these planes by 2 pi over 3, it gives us the same set of roots. So the set of roots are invariant under this 2 pi over 3 rotation. But this doesn't work if we include these 8 spinner weights at the bottom of the table. The same triality rotation of these weights gives us 8 new weights that aren't in the table, and another application of the same rotation gives us 8 more. But if we include these two sets of triality partners in a larger group with 48 roots, we do have a root system with triality. It's the root system of the rank 4 exceptional Lie group, F4. Next page, please. This particular triality rotation permutes 3 of the F4 coordinates. Applying it 3 times to any root gets us back where we started. Applying this triality rotation to the positive chiral 8 spinner gives us a triality equivalent 8 vector, and applying this triality rotation to that gives us a negative chiral 8 spinner. Since these new fields have the same quantum numbers under this triality symmetry, we label them as the 3 generations of fermions, with smaller triangles for their symbols in the tables and plots. This assignment of particles to triality partners is tentative, and I expect the 3 physical generations of fermions to have some more complicated relationship to these triality partners. But for now, we can plot the 48 roots of the F4 root system, rotated and projected down to 2 dimensions. Next page, page 17. This shows the gravel-weak gauge fields in 3 generations of leptons, with lines connecting the triality partners. Since projection is a linear operation, we can still compute interactions, allowed interactions, by adding the roots visually. For example, the yellow W+, over there on the far right, interacts with any of the left chiral electrons, the yellow triangles on the left, to give left chiral electron neutrinos, the darker yellow triangles on the right. We're limited, though, in what we can do in this diagram, because there are no antifermions here, and no quarks or gluons. To get the whole picture, we have to combine F4 and G2. Okay, next page, please. Okay, so if we fit F4 and G2 together, we give the root system of the most mathematically and aesthetically beautiful Lie group there is, the largest simple exceptional Lie group, E8. Physically, F4 has the quantum numbers for the gravel-weak interaction and the 3 generation structure, while G2 has the strong interaction, the hypercharged piece, and the antiparticle structure. Consistently combining the roots of these 2 Lie groups gives the quantum numbers of all particles in the standard model. In order to match them up, we need to introduce a new quantum number, W, with values determined by the values of the others. Knowing the quantum numbers of the standard model allows us to identify each elementary particle as one of the roots of the E8. Now, if we start with E8, we can break its Lie algebra down to the subalgebras of the standard model. It breaks up into F4 and G2, which operate on their smallest irreducible representation. The 26 is the traceless exceptional Jordan algebra and the smallest irreducible representation space of F4. And the 7 is the smallest irreducible representation of G2. These break up further to give the algebras of the standard model gauge field, gravity, 3 generations of fermions, and a handful of new fields. The weights of the standard model and gravitational fields fit perfectly to the 240 roots of E8, and we can plot it. So next page, please, page 19. This is a projection of the E8 root system from 8 dimensions down to 2, with each root labeled by an elementary particle symbol. We can see every allowed interaction in the standard model by adding these roots together. It's kind of hard to do in this plot, which shows the vertices of the E8 polytope spread out into 8 concentric circles. Now, this was first drawn by hand in 1964. To see the standard model structure here, we'll want to rotate our viewing plane in 8 dimensions until we can see the F4 and G2 subalgebras. Now please page forward 4 pages. We are rotating in 8 dimensions until we see the F4 subalgebra of E8. Now we'll rotate the viewing plane a little towards the G2 root system, which is orthogonal to the F4 system in E8. Please page forward 2 pages. The gluons emerge here from the center, and the quarks and antiquarks spread away from the leptons. Now we continue rotating from the plane of F4 to that of G2. Please page forward 5 pages, page 30. It's the same title, and you should get X's along the top at the stopping points.
Okay.
So we see the, once we're on page 30, we should see the 27 elements of the exceptional Jordan algebra converging for each color and anticolor. The central cluster of leptons are in the center of this diagram, and these leptons in gauge fields are the 72 roots of the E6 subgroup of E8. Now go ahead and page forward 3 pages, and we'll go ahead and see the G2 subalgebra of E8.
Which is the final page?
The final page is page 37, and the G2 subalgebra is on page 33, which is, should be what you're looking at. But we can go ahead and get back to go to the end of the animation, which is on page 37. It's the final X. If you see the E8 periodic table, you've gone too far. So page back. If you get to there, page back 1 page, so you can see the last slide that shows back where we started. And that concludes a brief tour of the E8 root system. It's very beautiful, and there are many other wonderful structures hiding in here. And we couldn't have asked for a better fit of the standard model in gravity into a Lie algebra. We can assemble a periodic table from the structure of E8 and compare it to the periodic table we built for the standard model. So now please go to the next page. This should be the E8 periodic table. This table displays the algebraic structure of E8. The SO71 subalgebra is the cluster of elements on the left, and there's an SO8 subalgebra cluster at the bottom. This SO71 and SO8 act on 3 generations of 64 fermion fields. It's a perfect match to the standard model. There are only a handful of new fields, which are labeled here as W and X phi. These new fields are suspiciously similar to the gravitational spin connection and frame Higgs fields, but I'm not sure what to make of that yet. Just if we compare their structure between what's at the bottom and what's on the left there, these new fields that are black here on the diagram look very similar in structure to the other field, the way they interact. The X interacts weakly, and the scalar big phi has color interacting with the quark, and the W is a new U1 field. We haven't seen these fields in accelerators, so if they exist, they must have large masses. But I don't think they're bad, since a set of Higgs fields like this seems promising for producing the CKM matrix. I've also colored these new weakly interacting massive particles a suggestively dark color, but I don't want to say anything more about that. So this is an amazingly good match of every field we know of to one of the most beautiful algebraic structures in mathematics. So let me turn away from the pretty pictures and get to the nitty-gritty of the dynamics, which is also very pretty in its own way. So next page, please, page 39. This should show the E8 connection. The E8 connection breaks up into the standard model pieces of the Lie algebra. The H1 is the SO71 Gravelique connection, which is made up of the SO31 spin connection, the frame Higgs in the mixed electroweak parts, and the left and right SU2 electroweak fields. The H2 is the SO8 connection, containing the SU3 gluon, an electroweak U1, and a new U1, and the new XC field. The Grassmann fields in the connection are the 3 generations of fermions, related by triality. When we compute the curvature of this connection, it'll break up into these same algebraic parts. I should probably break here and ask if there are any questions so far in this for this talk. I'm not getting a response, so I'll just.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. Can you say something about how the fermion representations assembled from real representations of E8 to the complex representations we need?
Yes, this is part of the structure of E6, and I didn't mention it here, but I talk about it a bit in the paper. What happens is E6 has an SO10 subgroup and a U1, and this U1 subgroup of E6 ends up being the complex structure. So these fermions, which start out in a real representation of F4, when we consider how this is embedded in E6, which is embedded in E8, they get a complex structure in here, which is the I. So we have, in a sense, we have two copies of a real representation of these fermions. And these two copies add to give us a complex representation for the fermions. That's a verbal description of what's going on. But to actually, you know, confirm that, you have to play with the mathematics for quite a bit. But that's a verbal description of what's going on.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. Any other?
Can you tell us what is H2 again? What
yes.
The omega is?
Yes, so in this E8 connection, the H1 is the SO7 one, which contains the gravitational spin connection, the omega, and the mixed electroweak parts, which is the frame Higgs, and the electroweak parts. Now, the H2 is the SO8. So this E8 V algebra, which is a non-compact version of E8, contains a separate SO7-1 and SO8 subalgebras. Okay, so these are both orthogonal subalgebras in E8. Okay, in fact, E8 contains SO16, or for the non-compact version, SO15-1 as its maximal subalgebra.
And what are the interpretations of little omega D2 X phi and G again?
Yeah, so little omega is a Clifford bivector valued one form. So it's an SO31 valued one form. It's a gravitational spin connection.
So does little omega appear both in H1 and H2? Are there two?
No. Little omega appears only in H1. The thing there
the other one is a
W, yes. And that W is a U1 field. And the reason I've made it a W, which looks a heck of a lot like an omega, is I have a hunch that these two are related, but I don't know how that works yet in theory.
Okay, so but, W is a U1, and then
B2 is what? B2 is another U1. B2 is the baryon lepton U1. Okay. It's the baryon lepton quantum number. And that's we need that piece to put together with the B1. And when we combine that B2 and B1, we get hypercharge out and another quantum number.
Okay, and X5 is a new piece.
Yes, X5 is a new piece.
And what about G?
G are the SU3 gluons.
Okay. And is W a new U1 connection? Or?
Yes, W is a new U1 connection. Presumably it's very massive. It's either very massive or it fits in with the omega in a way that isn't clear to me yet.
Okay.
But it's new.
What is the meaning of the under bars and over bars that appear here?
Yes, this is how I keep track of the grades of these objects. So the under bar denotes it's a one form. Okay, and if you see two underbars, that means it's a two form. So if you don't like them, just imagine they're not there. But that's how I keep track of the grades of these things. And the dots, if you have a dot under something, it means it's a Grassmann number.
And what about the overbars in R, G, and B?
The overbars R, G.
Like in H2, like the third line below H2, second line below.
Second line below H2.
There is a phi.
That means that's the anti-red, anti-green, and
okay.
Anti-blue.
Thank you.
So this new large phi is a colored scalar field. That's a set of colored scalar fields. And they're colored and anti-colored, just like the quarks.
Thanks.
For scalar field. Okay. I'll go and continue now, unless there's any other burning questions.
Okay, so just to make sure that in addition to the standard model, the only new particles are W and this X5, is that right?
That's right. However, in the Petit-Salam model, remember, we have this B1 and B2 fields, which combined give us our U1 hypercharge field.
Right.
There are two of them, so there's this other field that's a partner to the hypercharge that's another U1 that comes in.
Right.
So if you add them all up total, there are 20 new fields, degrees of freedom here. The XV, the W, and this new partner to hypercharge that comes out of the Petit-Salam model.
Okay, thank you.
Which isn't too bad considering, you know, we're starting out with E8 having 248 roots or Lie algebra elements total, and there are only 20 here that are new. So it's not as bad as some other unification schemes where you have a lot more particles, exotic particles left over. Plus, I think these are actually going to be useful. So. So they're not just a lot of extra things flying around that I'm going to hand wave away completely. Okay, so I'll go back and start from the description of this slide, which is that the E8 connection breaks up into the standard model pieces of the Lie algebra. The H1 is the SO71 gravel-weak connection, which is made up of the SO31 spin connection, the frame Higgs in the mixed electroweak part, and the left and right SU2 electroweak field. The H2 is the SO8 connection containing the SU3 gluon, an electroweak U1, and an UU1, and then UXV field. The Grassmann fields in the connection are the three generations of fermions related by triality. When we compute the curvature of this connection, which we're going to do next, it will break up into these same algebraic parts. So, on to the next page. The calculation of the curvature is straightforward, and it breaks up into many familiar pieces inhabiting various parts of this Lie algebra. The SO31 part is the Riemann curvature plus an area bivector term times phi squared, the square of the Higgs amplitude. In the mixed electroweak part, we get a non-dynamical torsion coupled to our Higgs and the covariant derivative of the Higgs, and we get the curvatures of the electroweak gauge field. The SU3 part is the curvature for the gluons, and the rest of SO8 is the curvature of these new fields that I don't completely understand yet, but I can write it down. Now, the coolest thing that happens is in the fermionic part of the curvature. The exceptional structure of E8 implies the bosons act on the fermions as left and right multiplication of matrices in fundamental representation spaces. This gives us exactly the correct covariant Dirac derivative operator on the fermions in curved spacetime. Now, using this curvature, we can write the action for everything in a very concise form. So, next page, please. The most natural and efficient way to express the action for the standard model in gravity in this model is as a modified BF action. We introduce a combined two-form plus anti-Grassmann three-form field, B, as Lagrange multiplier. So the dot over it means it's anti-Grassmann, and the number of lines underneath it is the grade of the space-time form. So we then handpick two modifying terms for this BF theory, quadratic and B, in order to match the action of the standard model. It would be nice if there were a better mathematical justification for the symmetry breaking that we're doing, but for now we just do it because it works. So we're breaking the symmetry by hand in order to get from a BF theory to the standard model action. So varying the B field and plugging this back in gives us the correct Dirac action, the Einstein-Hilbert action for gravity, and the action for the other bosons. I skipped a lot of steps here, which I'll cover in later in a couple of pages. But for now, the cosmological constant in this theory comes out equal to 3/4 the Higgs vacuum expectation value squared, which is very large. Okay, this is a feature of this paper, and I can't make it go away. It just has this very large cosmological constant that comes out. And the resulting vacuum solution of Einstein's equation is the Sitter spacetime. And it's worth noting that this vacuum solution for the spin connection, frame, and Higgs corresponds to a vanishing E8 curvature, which is kind of cute. Now I'm going to go and cover those steps I skipped from the second to third line in that equation there. So we're going to look at each part of this action in more detail, starting with the next page, which should be page 42. The gravity in this theory is described using the McDowell-Mansuri approach. The gravitational part of the action involves the SO31 part of the E8 curvature, so it's that subalgebra of the E8 curvature we're looking at here. And this includes the Riemann curvature as well as the area bivector terms multiplying the Higgs. Varying B, this is the gravitational part of the B, and plugging this back in gives the action quadratic in the curvature. And multiplying this out gives three terms. So we just take that equation for the action that's about in the middle of the page, and we multiply that out, and we get three terms. The first is the turn times boundary term, and we toss that. We also get the space-time volume element from putting those two area bivectors together, and we get the curvature scalar. Now, adding these last two terms gives the Palatini action, equivalent to the Einstein-Hilbert action, with this cosmological constant related to the Higgs step. Now, this calculation is the same as you can see in Lee and Lon's papers on modified BF gravity, on topological description of gravity, or modified topological description of gravity. Now, please turn to the next page.
Question before you go ahead.
Yes.
So from the EA point of view, what breaks the symmetry here, am I right, is the gamma matrix, which is some matrix with the algebra element, which breaks the symmetry down from the EA to the SO31?
That's exactly right. So if you look at the equation at the top line, there's BG, BG, gamma. This we pulled from our action for everything, which we assembled by hand to get this part that worked out right for gravity. And the way we did this is we used this gamma, which is a Lie algebra element of the 8, and it's in the SO71. What we did is we took this SO71 part of E8. We use a Clifford algebra to represent the element, to represent CL71. And using the Clifford algebra, we build this gamma matrix. And what this gamma does, effectively, is it acts as an algebraic version of the Hodge dual to take BG to its dual algebraic element in SO31. Okay, so this is the same as if you multiply this in, right? And we can do everything here, so we can plug this in and get everything in coefficients if we want. And if we do everything out in coefficients, what happens is this gamma will give us a Levi-Civita permutation symbol with four indices that'll take the components of BG, the algebraic components of BG, to its dual in the Lie algebra. Okay, but using Clifford algebra, we can do it without any components. And it looks kind of like magic, I admit, but it all works out, and it works in components when you run through the calculation. Similarly, the penultimate line there, where I say that expression is equal to the volume element times the scalar curvature, the only way I can calculate that out is by changing everything in that expression into components with the permutation symbols, which then contract and give you delta functions, and everything works out, and then you end up getting the curvature scalar out. But once you write it out algebraically like this, it's correct, but without indices, it looks kind of like magic. Okay, so if there aren't any other questions about this page, we'll go on to the next one, which is the fermionic part of the action. Now, once again, in order to get this to work perfectly, we have to take these E's out of the connection, as we did in the action, and put them here in this anti-Grassmann 3 form, which are our anti-fermions, as well as a couple bits of the frame. And if we assume that for our B dot, I don't have a better reason for this other than that it works perfectly, then we get the massive Dirac action in curved spacetime. So this is the fermionic part of the BF part of that action we wrote down. So this is a pure BF term, but now with these Grassmann-valued numbers in it, this turns out to be the massive Dirac action, curved spacetime. So this is a really neat result, because all the interactions we want are here, including this correct factor of 1/4 in front of the spin connection. And the coframe, which has a vector over it, that's the inverse of the frame. And since it's the inverse of the frame, when that contracts with the frame, it cancels. It gives you a factor of 4, actually. And what we get out is exactly the standard interaction term between the fermions and the Higgs. So this way, this is how the fermions get Dirac masses in the standard way when the Higgs gets a vacuum expectation value. Now, there's also an interaction here with the new fields that I don't understand yet, but it seems promising for getting the CTM matrix. Okay, so now we'll go on to the next page for the summary. The idea proposed here is an extreme unification. Everything is described with one E8 principal bundle connection. All known fields of the standard model in gravity match the algebraic structure of E8, and their interactions and dynamics come from the curvature and action of this connection. Since a principal bundle, geometrically, consists of the E8 Lie group manifold twisting and dancing over a four-dimensional spacetime, everything here is described by pure geometry. I think it's a very appealing picture of the universe, but of course, it could be wrong. This picture is so simple that it leaves no room for error. It's either going to be right and make many successful predictions as this theory develops, or it's just spectacularly wrong. It could be either one. So far, the theory looks very good, but it's young, and there's still much to understand about it. So next page, please. 45. I'm going to talk about this slide in reverse order, because I changed my mind about what the best order should be. But we'll read from the bottom up, I guess. So currently, this action is assembled by hand. So I'm going to talk about the inadequacies of this model and I think what needs improvement. It's the action and the symmetry breaking is done by hand to match the standard model down from E8. It's very efficient, but this is mathematically currently unjustified and kind of ugly. So I think this needs improvement. Also, the way the three physical fermion generations work and how these new W and XC fields fit in is not perfectly understood yet. Now, finally, and I think most importantly, this theory requires a fundamental quantum description. It's compatible with various approaches, but it's not a fully quantized theory itself yet. Most of the discussion I've made has been classical. So this requires a fundamental quantum description. Since it is a background independent theory of a connection, and only a connection, it is philosophically and technically aligned with the goals and methods of loop quantum gravity. Successful techniques developed to quantize the gravitational connection should extend to describe a quantum theory of this very large connection. It's just a matter of scale. I mean, it's a large matter of scale, but still, just qualitatively, the same problems are to be solved, and no more than that. Now, a background independent quantum E8 theory depends on the success of the quantum gravity program. So if these two theories both work out, and they work together, I think we'll have a fully successful theory of everything. Now, that's pretty much the end of my talk, and so I'll go ahead and see if there are some questions. I'm sure there are.
Right. So in a previous transparency somewhere, you said that, I agree that it's very economical and so on, but you said so far it seems to work very well, except for this cosmological concept, right? I mean, you indicate that if you agree, if you identify phi to the Higgs field, and then from the experiment data that we know, the cosmological constant is turning out to be too large.
It's very much too large. But remember, this is unification, presumably, at very high energy. So what happens is all these constants, such as the cosmological constants, are going to run. And I used to think this was a terrible bug. I used to think this was just a terrible thing that came out of this theory, right? This very large cosmological constant. But in the recent work of Ruder and Pacacci, what they're finding is they start out with a large cosmological constant, and at low energies it runs down to a very tiny energy when they do their effective gravitational field theory. It has this asymptotic safety property with a very large cosmological constant. So these are compatible ideas. And I agree that this is, kind of shaky at this point. And, you still have to wonder about this large cosmological constant. But there's no way I can get rid of it. So either it's going to be true that this large cosmological constant runs down to a tiny value, or this theory is wrong. But right now I think I'm still alive.
I think we're just asking for clarification. I mean, I agree that we can't solve everything at the same time. There are issues and problems with this Reuter-Pacacci proposals, but maybe we should talk about it separately and not mix it with this particular discussion. So supposing we do actually think about this one connection, right? And then we'll consider the holonomies of these connections and so on.
Yes.
And so this holonomy is going to be taking values in E8. And therefore, if you look at quote-unquote fluctuations of this holonomy, one is going to get all the standard model particles, right?
Yes, that's right.
So in some sense, it is like string theory in which particles are coming out of kind of perturbations of one-dimensional object, which is the holonomy. I'm combining ideas from loop quantum gravity to what you're telling us now. So there is a dramatic difference from the way that normally one does gauge theories, where fermions are sitting at vertices.
Yes.
And the gauge fields are sort of running along the edges.
Yes, that's right. All we have here is a connection.
Right. So, I just would like to know, how do we reconcile the two pictures? I mean, there's something right about the standard picture also, that the fermions are sitting at the vertices because that's where the charge is. If I look at, calculate the flux lines in electromagnetic theory, then I would find that they don't completely, if the flux lines, if the quantum numbers are such that the flux doesn't add up to zero at a vertex, then we say there is a particle of certain charge at that vertex.
Yes.
So how would you say, I mean, nothing is happening here at the vertices, right? I mean, there are no particles. Everything is on the, only on the edges.
Yes, that's right. Now,
reconcile.
This is the thing. Is I'm hoping this inspires this thought, and you might have some ideas on it because I'm not a spin network expert. So I'm not sure how to build models that incorporate this idea where everything is in the connection, including the matter being part of this connection.
I think it's certainly possible. I just want to make sure that we don't miss something that you already know.
Oh no, this is why I'm thinking we'll make a good team. You see.
Right. Okay. No, I think. Just one more question. Long time, I mean, in the 80s, basically,
yes.
Maybe 90s. In the 90s, Peter Feldman had tried to do such a unification by basically, I mean, this is in some sense, anti-Kaluza Klein philosophy, in which we keep the space-time dimension the same, and we make the group larger and larger, the internal group larger and larger.
Yes, I've read Feldman's paper very many times on his Hamiltonian review of Hamiltonians for gravity. Yes.
So my question is really that when you are doing it, I mean, most of the concrete work was done in three-dimensional space-time.
Yes.
And he was getting from this point of view of a large internal group, he was getting Young-Mills kind of interactions. But there are always a host of correcting terms which do not appear in standard Young-Mills theory.
Right.
Well, are there going to be such terms here?
Well, remember at this point, I made the action in order to agree with the standard model. So we assembled the action by hand. So by virtue of doing that, it exactly matches the standard model. It's a very concise and efficient way of expressing it. But in order to make it efficient, there were a couple of extra terms that came out. There was an extra term that, so the torsion does appear in this theory.
Right.
This is in more. I didn't even mention it here. Well, I mentioned it, but I didn't write out the equations for it. But this part is in the paper. And so there are a couple of extra terms, but there's nothing really nasty or because sort of by design, by the way we built it, it matches the standard model. So in one sense, it's unsatisfying in that we don't have a reason for picking the action that we can. We can't, it's not possible to pick a Yang-Mills action a priori, I don't think, because there's no reason to pick out the SO3-1 as special unless you put that algebraic term in there, that gamma. That's a very important part of the symmetry breaking.
Can I comment, Garrett?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so this is Lisa. So I've been studying something like an application of Paldin and Chakrabarty. If people remember that old work where they took basically a Bayes formulation with the Poblansky formulation and extended from the Lorentz group to some larger group, and playing with that again, there's a lot to do, but the hypothesis is that there would be then an E8 invariant action that would have a symmetry breaking mechanism down essentially to the action that Garrett has, and certainly it's a lot of work, and I would hope maybe that other people would also get involved, but it certainly, you know, we already knew from Paldin and Chakrabarty that there were ways to extend a Bayes formulation to larger gauge groups and get to leading order and an expansion around this bitter space, Yang-Mills fields. Of course, there are mixings of what are supposed to be the internal Yang-Mills fields with the gravitational fields, and it is one of the issues that would have to come out right, that is, they would all have to be suppressed appropriately.
Yeah.
But I thought that Paris' idea point is that with his action, there are no such terms, and this is what I'm trying to understand.
Yes, we're all kind of dissatisfied with this action because, like I said, it's assembled by hand, and from
the. No, that's not right. But I think the existence is non-trivial.
I agree with you, but at the same time, I think it's time to be braver and do what Lee said, which is to start out with an action that takes this E8 group theory seriously. So you start out with an action that is E8 symmetric, but that breaks the symmetry in a more natural way, starting out with the E8 perspective, and that breaks the symmetry dynamically down to the standard model. I think this is a great thing to look for, and it would be great if it could be found. But yes, it's encouraging that the standard model action can be written like this. But I think when we find a really nice action that looks mathematically cleaner in a way, that it'll deviate a little bit from the standard model, but in such a way that might be permissible. But this is wishful thinking, but I think it's something really fun to work on. And also, I want to add another note, and that is that this theory, I don't consider it to be my theory. It's not my intent to claim this just popped out of my head. This is come together from the work of many other people, and I'm hoping that a lot of other people will consider it interesting enough to work on.
Well, you're too modest. Okay. Let's go back to page 41, just for those of us who don't know much about this.
Page 41, okay, sure.
Yeah, action for everything.
Yes.
Okay. So, I mean, you all explained all these things, and Lee even commented to make it clearer, but just one last summary. So we got this action, which is PS, and then P is this Lagrange multiply kind of form
right.
That you wrote down at the top. And then you've got a kind of a interaction term, phi tilde.
Yes. So that's
which is of H1, H2.
That's right. This phi tilde is just the modification term to the pure BF theory.
Right. And so let's walk us through it again. So phi tilde is supposed to presumably is a four form, right? And the whole thing is a four form.
Yes, that's right. So the tilde denotes it as a four form because I didn't want to write four little lines under it.
Right. So it's a four form.
And it's these two terms. The first term on the next line below it is the BG BG gamma. So BG is the gravitational part of this Lagrange multiplier algebraically. So this is the part that gives this MacDowell-Mansuri gravity. And the other part is the...
So what is gamma again?
Gamma is an algebraic element of V8. It's the Clifford volume element, if you like. It's a special algebraic element that takes BG to its algebraic dual in spacetime.
Okay.
Now the other term, this is a term that breaks the symmetry and gives us gravity. Now the other term is the term for the gauge fields, and it includes the hot star. Now this hot star, in my opinion, is really pretty ugly from the perspective of E8, because in order to build that hot star there, which we need if we're going to have general covariance of the theory, we need to pull the E out of our connection and use it in that hot star. So we have to pull the E out, invert it, square it, and then use that in the hot star to build this term. Now from E8 theory perspective, that's a pretty ugly thing to do. But that's how we do it by hand. And when we do that, we get the standard model action. And I didn't cover it here in this talk, but in the paper, you can see that the action for the Higgs is in there in that term as well.
Thank you very, very much.
Certainly.
Another question about this. What is the meaning of the prime? I think you said it as
the prime. Yes, the BG is for gravity, and the B prime means it's the part of B that's not gravity. it's everything else in the Lie algebra.
So it's because V8 mod the Lorentz group.
That's right. So if I'm not sure if it should be there or not. It was the cleanest way to get to the gravitational action. But if we included the gravitational part in that Yang-Mills term, then we'd get what's called the SKY Lagrangian term for gravity. And it's an interesting question whether or not we need that prime there or not. But just to avoid difficulties, and since we're assembling the action by hand anyway to match the standard model, I left it in. Are there any other questions? I've also got a, if we have extra time, I've got a couple bonus slides, one discussing the pure geometry and the other what I mean by a super connection in this context.
Okay.
book, so why I can get away with having Grassmann valued Lie algebra elements as opposed to just one form Lie algebra elements as part of this connection.
Yeah, we have time.
Please go ahead.
Oh, you'd like to see it. Okay. All right, so if everybody sort of takes a deep breath, and then we can page down to page 46, which is the BRST extended connection. Now, this is a hypothesis I have for how we can start purely with an E8 principal bundle connection, which is a set of E8 Lie algebra valued one forms, and then separate the algebra into two different parts of the Lie algebra, which I'm calling the bosonic and fermionic parts of the Lie algebra. And then when we take our action, which is a BF modified BF theory with the same other modifying terms, but purely for this principal bundle connection now, the fermionic part of this connection, because there are no modifying terms for it, is a pure gauge part of the connection, which means we can gauge transform it away. We can make a gauge transformation that takes it to zero locally. Now, if we use the BRST gauge fixing technique, what we can do is we can replace this part of the action, which is one forms, with BRST ghosts, which are Grassmann numbers valued in the same part of the Lie algebra. And we can use this and then assemble an extended connection, which is a kind of super connection, which is this H part of the Lie algebra still remaining as a one form. Plus now we have these Grassmann numbers still valued in the fermionic part of the Lie algebra. And we can compute the curvature for this thing, which is the BRST extended curvature. And for this curvature, out pops the curvature of the H part of this connection and the covariant derivative of the Grassmann field. And this is the technique we use, and this is the starting place for this paper. So I didn't include these two upper steps because they're rather controversial. Peter White and I seem to like them, but I haven't found anybody else who likes this idea. But pretty much you get the fermions by replacing the pure gauge part of the connection with ghosts. And once you do that, the BF term in your original BF theory, and this BF term, which includes the anti-ghosts now and this extended curvature, gives you exactly the Dirac action with a liberal interpretation of what these anti-ghosts are as anti-fermions and including parts of the frame. So this is how I think we get to a super connection after starting with just a normal connection. But if people like to start with a super connection and they're comfortable with that, I think that's fine. Now go ahead and go to the next page, please. Now on this page, what I'm describing is something I mentioned a couple times in the talk, which is that this theory really is a theory of pure geometry. And in my opinion, it's the geometry of Yang-Mills theory is in a way more natural than the Riemannian geometry of general relativity, because you don't need a metric. From differential geometry perspective, a metric is kind of a strange thing, right? It's something you have to add to a manifold. Whereas in this theory of a connection, all you have is a description of a Lie group, which is a manifold, which has these vector fields on it corresponding to diffeomorphisms under which the manifold is symmetric. And the symmetries of the manifold are what correspond to your Lie algebra elements. So each Lie algebra element corresponds to a vector field on this manifold. And the Lie derivative between these vector fields gives us a structure constant, the same way that the Lie brackets give us the same structure constant. And once you have these structure constants over a Lie group, of course, you can build a Killing form, which is a way of deriving a metric structure over this Lie group manifold. And the frame for this manifold comes out by inverting one of these vector fields. So this is the geometric picture of what a Lie group is. And for EA to be a 248-dimensional manifold, so it's really big. But we're not doing Kaluza-Klein theory here when we put it over a base manifold, a four-dimensional base manifold, because this by the geometry of the principal bundle, this Lie group manifold is frozen. Okay, it doesn't wiggle or contract or anything. It just it changes, it sort of twists over the base space, but its shape, the shape of the Lie manifold, the group manifold itself, doesn't change. But you can describe how it's twisting over a four-dimensional base manifold using this connection. And this connection, which exists in the entire space, which I guess in this case would be a 252-dimensional space, is a vector-valued one form, which you can use to contract with vectors, which maps vectors from the entire space into the tangent space of this Lie group manifold at each point over the base manifold. So this is a purely geometric description of Yang-Mills theory. So what you might have thought was algebra in this theory is really pure geometry. So this is why I think from this perspective, this theory is very pretty, because it's purely talking about this very, very pretty shape. And this is and that's it. There's no other structure, just this shape twisting around and providing all the particles, interactions, and dynamics, which I think is very pretty. So that's it for the bonus slides. I won't talk about the last one unless people absolutely insist.
So I insist.
No, I really don't want to talk about the last one. because this is a point that seems fairly clear, but it's been undergoing quite a bit of debate on the internet, but who is that sort of thing, right?
Let's see, so there's a lot of gravity people in the audience who might not have thought much about the Kolmogorov-Mandula theorem, so you want to say a few words and explain all of it?
Sure, okay. So if you go in, there's a very powerful theorem from, I'm not sure exactly what the year is. Is it 67? Or I can't remember exactly what the year was, but the Kolmogorov-Mandula basically says, it assumes about five different conditions having to do with the S matrix for scattering. So the idea is that you have plane waves coming in and out and interacting, and these things have quantum numbers for gravity and quantum numbers for other gauge fields. And there's a theorem that says you cannot combine these into the quantum numbers of a larger group over when you have these interactions in the S matrix. So they can't be combined in a non-trivial way. And this is sort of exactly what I'm doing. It appears I'm violating this theorem. But in fact, I'm not violating this theorem, because if you go and look at condition one of the Kolmogorov-Mandula theorem, which I've written for you above, the first condition is that G contains a subgroup locally isomorphic to the Poincaré group. And the S matrix itself, which is sort of condition zero, because it's the first line here, it's condition zero of this theorem, is that we're dealing with an S matrix. But the thing is in order to build an S matrix, you have to start out with these plane wave states. So you're dealing with a flat space-time background. And in this theory, in this E8 theory, not only does it not depend on a flat space-time background, but it does not even allow a flat space-time background. It is not allowed to have a cosmological constant equal to zero. Okay, because if that happened, the gravitational frame wouldn't be appear in the theory. Okay, because of the way the McDowell-Mansuri approach works. So this is the way this theory gets around this Kolmogorov-Mandula theorem. If there are questions about that, I'd be happy to discuss it further. Well, maybe not so happy, but I'd encourage you to look at the net to see how the debate is unfolding, mostly on Sabina Hassenfelder's blog, more than anywhere else, which I think is up to 160 comments or something by now.
But the thing is that in the Kolmogorov-Mandula case, the Poincaré group is supposed to be really space-time group, which is, it really moves points of space-time.
Yes.
Whereas
what you have in
the source 3-1
is really a local Lorentz group, not to be confused with the Lorentz subgroup of isometric group of its
characteristics.
Yes, that's right. So I think it's a completely different framework. Yes, it is a completely different framework, and that's entirely the point. That's why I didn't want to discuss it, but nevertheless, this is what string theorists and some other particle theorists who aren't as familiar with general relativity are hammering me with, and I'm having to counter that it's a completely different framework.
I'm on the same wavelength as you. I have a question about the last two things that you said. I mean, the geometry of Yang-Mills theory, I think we all understand and appreciate. The BRST case, I mean, what is the motivation for extension? Is it only mathematical, or is there some physical reason to?
Yes, I really wish I had a geometric description of BRST theory, and many people have tried to build one and describe it geometrically, but there isn't one that I'm really happy with. So for now, this exists as a mathematical trick, as I understand it, to go from a connection with a pure gauge part to a this kind of super connection, which
right.
has these two parts that are only formally added.
But from your perspective, why is it even necessary to do that if, in fact, all the observed standard model particles are already there before you do this extension?
Oh, because before you do this extension, they're not Grassmann-numbered Lyapunov elements. They're one-form Lyapunov elements, and that's not what we see. We have Grassmann-valued things in the standard model. So this is a trick I figured out to get from one to the other.
Yeah, thank you.
Are there any other questions?
Okay, well, thank you very much. This has been some very, this has been an enjoyable talk, and I've enjoyed taking and discussing your questions.
Thank you, Garrett.